This is the PubRight Podcast, a service of the Arbortex community.
We have today Gareth Oakes, from formerly of Advent, currently at GPSL, Global Publishing Solutions, and he is an APP 3B2 specialist. Gareth, tell us, welcome, say hello, tell us about yourself.
Hello, listeners. How are we going? My background is pretty technical. I've sort of been programming since I was 9 years old and went to university, did all that sort of comp sci stuff. Ended up doing some early sort of web online learning stuff with the Blackboard platform and things at a university. Got bored of that, went to the UK, kind of fell into a C programming position with the Advent 3B2 guys. Was pretty excited and impressed with the product after working it for a year or so, and they pulled me out to go work on the actual projects team. They figured that I could actually talk to customers as well as write code, so that was a good thing. And one thing led to another. I ended up coming back to Sydney to work in a joint venture with like a local reseller, basically, and the Advent 3B2 main body. And around the time, I'd done a couple of years work there and worked on some pretty cool stuff, and we're developing a product called Pure, which was kind of like a simplified version of 3B2. But Arbortex then acquired 3B2. I guess 3B2 had got themselves into a little bit of financial strife by that point due to various reasons. And Arbortex then offered me a position doing programming again, because I was, by that point, I was kind of more of a solutions developer. And I guess I kind of agreed to that. And initially, it was meant to be going to Ann Arbor to work with those guys. But at last minute, my old programming boss stole me back, and I ended up back in the UK again. So I spent another year in the UK doing programming again. So I sort of went back to my roots there for about a year, and I was working on the integration of Styler with 3B2 and sort of developed the first prototypes for that, did a lot of the initial research and stuff. And then an opportunity came up. By that point, Arbortex had been bought by PDC. An opportunity came up. PDC needed like a pre-sales sort of guy back here in Australia. So I got on a plane again and ended up back working at the Gold Coast, which is my original sort of home where I grew up, and I'm now back here again. And I sort of worked remotely for PDC for a while. They're based down in Sydney here. And yeah, and then eventually I was kind of getting sick of that, and they ended up making me redundant, which was actually pretty cool, because I ended up being able to work back with Laurie and the guys at GPSL again. So that's where I find myself now. And my role at the moment is kind of encompassing quite a lot of stuff, but is mainly a lot of pre-sales work, as well as a bit of high-end solution architecture, even a little bit of the programming or coding work from time to time. So it's kind of a well-rounded role that I've been enjoying. So that's really a quite detailed snapshot of where I've been and where I'm going and where I am and that sort of thing.
Wow, that's so much more information than I have ever had about you before.
Well, there you go. Now you know a bit of everything.
That is fabulous. So you were a developer on 3B2 in the early days.
Yeah, that's how I started out. Actually, my goal at the time was to be a Unix kernel developer, and I kind of got sidetracked by this 3B2 stuff and ended up doing a lot of the back-end C programming for the 3B2. Yeah, so.
Ah, interesting. Interesting, interesting. And you did the initial research to get Styler to work with 3B2.
Yeah, I did a lot of the initial sort of gap analysis, I guess you'd call it, between, because Styler is obviously a lot more dumbed down than what 3B2 has to offer, and the features aren't necessarily a one-to-one match. So it was a lot of figuring out how's this meant to work in 3B2's mindset, or how's 3B2's bits meant to work in Styler's mindset. And I wrote I'd call it a prototype. It was an XSLT combined with a Perl object model that basically took a Styler sheet, XSLT'd it down to a bunch of Perl objects, and then those Perl objects were run inside of 3B2, which built the template up. And that was kind of a good way for us to sort of flesh out a lot of the ideas and ways and means and things. And when I left UK, basically they were in a position then to be able to go forwards, and I think they have now done it properly, obviously, and kind of thrown away a lot of my Perl stuff, which isn't needed anymore, and done it all in the C code, which makes a lot of sense. But they've taken all the documents and stuff I generated and used that as a basis going forwards for how the block models should work and how everything sort of integrates together. So yeah, it's good work. Yeah,
good.
Interesting stuff.
So let's start there. Okay. We're all just, all the rest of us Arbortex folks are just now getting to see 3B2 really for the first time really ever. Mm-hmm. you know, with the technology preview in 5.4 and the release of being able to play with it a little bit in Styler. So start with what we know and try and lead us into what kinds of things you were looking at in order to make it work with 3B2.
Yeah, I was thinking about this before I got on the call with you, and I think a good place to start might be just one step back to set a basis for where these things come from. Back in the day, I guess, you know, when publishing on computers was a new and exciting and interesting thing, there was basically, I think, two different angles to the publishing. One of them is like on mainframes and Unix systems and things, was doing all the batch composition work, and there was a bunch of systems came from that angle. And then there was the whole, you know, desktops and mice and things are great and GUIs and look at all these colors and pretty things. And that was the desktop publishing side of things. And if you look at today, what's out there, I guess you can still see those historical remnants, you know, and things like the tech system that Arbitex uses underneath all the FOSSies and everything else came from more of that sort of batch composition and, you know, do things on the mainframe type of approach. And then 3B2 actually came from the other angle, which is more as a desktop publishing system. So it started life as a, this is back before we had Windows or anything else, obviously. It was a cross-platform system, ran on not only custom hardware, but also they ported it to DOS and Amiga and Mac and all these sort of things back in the day.
Oh, my God.
And yeah, and it was all a GUI. It was like a little publishing operating system because it had, like, you know, you could open files and delete files and work with things and all that, and you could bring up the pages and you'd use your little mouse to draw up the frames and type your text in and load up your graphics and all those sort of exciting things. It even had its own sort of vector graphics mode and all that stuff.
Wow.
And so that's kind of where it came from. But they got really smart, I think about version 3 or something, and they figured out that, hey, we've written this system here, and they wrote it pretty cleverly because, A, they based it on HTML for the actual text format underneath. It's not like a proprietary binary or anything.
Right.
It's all based on the standard tags and things from HTML. So I don't know how they figured that part out, but that was kind of around the time HTML came out. I think that was about 86, 87 when they released V1 or 3B2.
A VR outright.
Yeah, so they somehow had hooked up the right stuff underneath, which was quite clever. So when you load the text streams into 3B2, it's actually, you know, the tags are native tags and all that sort of thing, which is clever. And then the other clever thing they did was actually based everything on macros. So it's kind of like before we had a good concept, like we do these days, of programs having APIs and things, they had their own API, which is the scripting language, which is kind of native to it, which is what they call the 3B2 macro language. And that worked throughout the system because all the menu clicks and all the dialogues, everything, were just firing off macros, and it turned out that it was really easy to expose that macro language to the user, and that let you build your own sort of scripts and things. So they start out, you'd be able to sort of automate a bunch of stuff with just the macro language, and then the lead programmer, Dave Hartnell, added in a really basic conditional sort of format sort of language, so you could have not just these basic scripts, but you could have like more advanced scripts that had conditional jumps and tests and things in there. It was just like a real quick hack. It was meant to be a sort of quick hack to get a few jobs done the way they need to work by testing a few variables, and it kind of grew from there. And I guess you end up at the system where we are now with 3B2, where, you know, a lot of these features have sort of aggregated and got bigger and more hairy and more complex, and then they tacked Perl onto it to allow a lot more clever stuff. And that's kind of the way it evolved from a desktop publishing system to, I'd say, one of the best automated composition systems in the world. So,
oh, I gotta go with you on that now that I've seen it more than once.
So you could still see the history in there, though, because you look at the 3B2 interface, if you ever bring it up, and it looks a bit retro and all that sort of thing. And that's because I guess they put a lot more work into the automation side of it now. Then, you know, it's not really a desktop publishing system anymore. They gave up on that idea a long time ago, and now, you know, the real value is in this automated composition, which is what they put all their effort into.
So it's funny you say you know, he started with this as you know, hacking onto it code. You can't ever say that I'm just going to do it now, it's not going to go into production, because somehow it always does.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, it's kind of evolved and become a very powerful but quite complex tool, I guess, you know, due to the nature of that growth.
Fascinating. So tell us, so give us a way to start thinking about it when, you know,
That's a good way to go next. So I'm going to start from the way Arbitex thinks, which when I first learned it was a bit alien to me, because I'd been sort of, before 3B2, the only sort of typesetting I'd ever dealt with is things like Microsoft Word and things. So
right.
everything I learned about composition sort of was from a 3x2 angle. So for me, the Arbitech stuff was kind of weird and different because it was very much a structured thing, whereas 3x2 sort of allows you to do all sorts of weird, crazy stuff. Arbitech's had, you know, there's one way to do footnotes, or there's one way to do this, and there's one way to do that, and it's all very structured. And the key difference is it's all driven off the XML, so
right.
or the HTML, I guess. Whereas with, if you contrast that to 3x2, why I'm saying that's different is 3x2 basically it doesn't really care about the structure. Like, you know, it kind of has an XML parser, but that was something that someone added in, you know, because someone needed to use XParse and things for a job. But that's not the core of it. The core of it is just, I guess I'd call it a character parser. So it basically just scans a stream. It starts at the top of the stream. And by stream, I mean a buffer or a text file or something. When they're loaded into a 3x2, they're called streams in the sort of 3x2 speak, if you like. It starts at the top of the stream. And basically, each character it sees, it just puts on the page. It doesn't care about if there's a structure or not to the document. It just puts the characters on the page. And if it reaches a tag, what it does is it actually, you know, jumps into that tag, so to speak. And what I mean by that is it'll go, the tag content will actually be another stream of the same name as the tag, and that's the way it works. So your main stream might be called, I don't know, stream zero or something. And then if you come across a tag called para, then it's going to go into a stream called para and do the same processing again. So if there's characters in para, they also get dumped onto the page. But then you ask me the question, well, how do you actually get anything styled up or formatted? Well, it turns out that 3x2 has this idea of paragraphs, and it uses processing instructions to control this paragraph display. And as well as paragraph, you also get text properties, so you can affect things like the bold and the underlines and the colours and things like that inline, as well as for whole paragraph blocks. And that's kind of different, again, to Arbitech, because in Arbitech, things are just blocks, you know.
Right.
It's similar to FO in that everything's sort of blocks that can be nested, and a block just starts and ends a line. And there's some subtle differences when you think about a paragraph model 3x2 versus the block model. Arbitech does things like collapse margins. So if you had a lot of white space beneath a block and then the next block had a lot of white space above it, it would collapse that white space down to just sort of be this, you know, the whatever was the most reasonable looking piece of space that should be there.
Right.
In 3x2, its paragraphs are strict spaces. So what I mean by that is they don't collapse. So if you had 6 points below and 6 points above the next one, then you get a 12-point gap. It doesn't just drop down to 6 points.
Okay.
And that's kind of an example of some of the differences that you get. And there's other, you know, subtle things around the block nesting and stuff as well, because blocks can nest, some of the properties can inherit down and things like that. Whereas with a paragraph model, basically every paragraph just resets the properties back to, you know, the basics that should be for the default paragraph. Properties that are in effect. I'm sort trailing quite into technical detail there, but that's kind of a way to start looking at the differences, I guess.
Okay, well, so go a little bit into the technical, just to give folks an idea of sort of how your brains work and how you guys think about things.
Yeah, another interesting difference then, if you looked at the page model, I guess in Arbitech you basically set up on the page set or whatever you want to call
right.
it, you set up your header footer areas and you've got your inside outside margins and the number of columns of which you obviously specify the width sort of gutters or both.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's kind of a model that works pretty well for TechDoc and for actually quite a lot of content. In 3x2, that because it's from the desktop side of things, it thinks about things as frames. So you actually... You don't just have this idea of headers, footers, and a main text area. You can have an arbitrary number of frames. You could have like 12 frames stacked up on the page, or you know, a main frame with another one overlaying it. You can rotate the frames and all sorts of crazy things like that that isn't normal for TechDoc, but is normal for desktop publishing. And I guess the power then comes from the fact of being able to automate that sort of frame-based layout, and you can do all sorts of weird things with anchoring and, you know, what you'd call floats in Arbitech, I guess. We call them floats as well, anchored floats. And, you know, you can do all sorts of crazy things because they can be all rotated and placed according to a very complex set of rules. That's another way of looking at the top down. So, you know, you look at your pages. The thing I like about Arbitech's page sets, though, is it's because of this strict sort of structure and rigorousness, it's a little bit quicker to set up your page layouts in Arbitech, I think, than 3x2, because 3x2 gives you all these millions of different options and controls. It takes you a while to sort of, you know, nail it down to what you need. So,
all right. So what's the craziest rule that you've come across? It can be really complicated, right?
Yeah, so some of the complicated rules around the anchored floats, they implemented stuff a while ago for it's called Auto Trader Magazine, so it's like classified ads, but they obviously have filler ads as well. And there was this idea of the ad placement automatically via these anchor controls. They'd say something like, if this ad appeared on a certain side of a page, then the facing page could not have another ad from this competing company. And then there was another rule that said, if I've got a dirty big black ad here, then at the back of that page, I should have another ad, or I shouldn't have another ad, or stuff like that, because it's very thin paper or whatever. So there's all sorts of crazy rules you can have that detect whether it was something on the back of the page and whether to place something here, and if there was something already there, should I go below, or do I go to the next page, or do I go to the next verso page? And you have this super duper set of complex, what we call anchor rules, about where a certain piece of extracted content's actually allowed to sit. And I guess that's getting towards the real extreme sort of stuff that you can come across in some of these page layouts.
Wow, that's very cool.
But
I
it's
mean,
possible.
yeah, th well, that's even better, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're trying to sell the world on APP. We love it. It's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah,
Everybody
it's
wants
very
to learn it.
powerful.
It is. You
and
know? Go ahead.
I guess the next bit I was going to say then is you think about the style of the 3B2 integration is kind of a good place to go next. And
Yeah.
that kind of does a lot of the work for you, because it bundles up all that complex rules and functions and codes and things into just a compatibility layer, I guess you call it, for stylus. So you can actually create your stylus sheet, and it will automatically build the 3B2 template for you with all the relevant styling properties and things applied. If you're just using it at that level, then that might actually be a good way to get started with 3B2, is to actually use the new styler to 3B2 feature to generate your first templates that way. And the good news is you can still do the overrides like you could for FOSI overrides. You can now do 3B2 overrides if you're targeting the 3B2 formatting engine. So you can build your template foundations using the built-in styler stuff, and then when you hit the limits, like you always do in these complex jobs, you can sort of drop in a 3B2 override for that particular context or whatever, and override the properties there, or call in one of these crazy anchor rules to place your floating object or whatever like that.
So was it easier or harder, or was it more straightforward to go from the Arbortext way to at least the 3B2 foundational stuff for Styler? Like, is it sort of genericized because the content's more regular, or the format?
Yeah, I guess that brings a lot of benefits. The real hard parts for the programmers, I guess, implementing this stuff was the fact that 3B2 thought about pages differently, like I was explaining before about the paragraphs
right.
versus the blocks.
Right.
So that, I mean, the most of it was quite easy, just, mapping the properties across. There was a lot of properties very similar. But then when you get to the block level properties, like the margins and things, that's where they had to add some extra functions, or, rejig how things were working and allow things to work that way.
Okay. That seems like the harder part, for sure.
Yeah, well, it's some fundamental things that are different, that needed to be synchronized, I guess you'd call it.
Well, so where would you suggest somebody who's learning start? Like, what things should they know off the top?
If you wanted to start with 3B2, I guess, like I said, a good place to start playing with it would be through the Styler integration, because that lets you, without having to really learn much more than you currently know, if you're an Arbortext user, you can get some 3B2 pages out pretty easily. Once you want to get past that level, then really you have to start looking at what's called the Foundation course, which is something that came from the Advent 3B2 days. PDC has a version of it. GPSL has a much more updated version of it, and that's sort of something that would be a good way to start, because the documentation that ships with the product, I guess similar to Arbortext, doesn't really come with a lot of that sort of introductory how to use it thing. It's more of a reference guide for developers and users and things like that than it is a training guide. So I guess once you got to the limits of your Styler to 3B2, you'd have to really look at doing some sort of training course, or get hold of the training materials and do a bit of self-paced learning or something like that.
Right. So what things should somebody who's starting like look out for? What's an obvious thing going to bite somebody first off?
Probably pretty much everything, because Struby2 works very differently underneath from a lot of other things. I think of the way that it works in programming terms similar to assembler language. And with Arbitex, you'd think of that much more like a high-level language, like a scripting language or something.
That's a good analogy.
The level of difference. Yeah, that's the analogy I like to use. So you have to really, I guess, have your wits about you when you first learn 3D2. you can pick up... Okay, if you use the GUI version of it as a desktop publishing tool, you can use the menus and kind of get things working that way. But to make the leap from just using menus to actually understanding how 3B2 works is kind of a big one without the help of the training materials and stuff. So that's the way I learned it, I guess. Even though I programmed it for a year or so, I still didn't really have much of an idea how to use it. So I had to do a sort of 2 to 3 week training course just to even learn the sort of fundamentals, how to drive the menus, and then how does that actually relate to way things work under the hood and things like that. Right. The first thing that people are going to come across, which is confusing, which is also one of the most powerful things, is a term called showstrings, okay. And that's 3B2's name for the generated text function. But it's kind of a Swiss Army knife generated text function because it does pretty much everything under the one command. So it's quite complex as well. It uses what I'd term a very terse language in that you have things like $x to display something, or plus x to increment something, or minus x to decrement, and it's not like a regular programming language. Again, it's like one of these assembler languages where it's very terse, sort of hard to follow syntax sometimes. The good news is there is what I call a showstring analyzer, so if you do come as you're learning, especially it's useful, you can come across what looks like a very terribly complex showstring. You can run this analyzer on it, and it will basically list out line by line what it's actually doing. So it's saying, you know, take this format counter and increment it by one, then test if this other one was the value 23. If so, output a string from this variable and da-da-da. It'll talk you through it.
Nice. Always good to have a sort of debugger function that'll step you through what you're doing and make sure you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, exactly. And that'll be the biggest learning hurdle, I guess, for anyone, would be getting their head around that showstring thing, because it's kind of the root of the power as well as sort of the root of a lot of the complexity. But, you know, once you get your head around that, things start to fall into place a little bit better.
So they see the debugger. How do they do that again? Say that one more time.
It's called the showstring analyzer. I believe the default is if you put a... You can change it with a command line parameter, but the default is if you put, I think, a tilde symbol at the start of the showstring, it'll all of a sudden start popping out dialog boxes that explain to you what's going on.
Great. So, excellent. Yep. So, I hear that despite your long history with 3B2, you're still learning stuff about it.
I think anyone involved with 3B2 still learns stuff, because it's been across so many different industries, from, you know, government legislation through to tech doc, through to catalogs, scientific, technical, medical journals, all legislation, all sorts of stuff. You know, everyone has their own angle on how things should work. And 3B2's gained a lot of features from all these different vertical markets, I guess you'd call it. And, you know, depending on what jobs you work with, like I've worked a lot with catalogs and tech docs and things like that, I know a lot of those type of features. But when it comes to someone like one of my colleagues, Michael Duffy's worked almost purely with financial publishing for annual reports and things, they use a totally different set of features. They're a lot more about their tables and obviously decimal alignments and things like that. But they don't really care too much about these funny anchored things and how floating graphics should place, because there aren't a lot of those annual reports. So I guess that's kind of where I was coming from with the still learning part is, you know, there's always different angles. Even though you might know all the features are there, once you actually delve into how to use them, you're still going to have to learn, you know, stuff about how these things all fit together. And we always use this term as a publishing toolbox to describe 3B2, because it gives you so many different tools and widgets and gadgets and things to do cool stuff on the pages that it's really up to you to use the tools and know how the tools work together. Because unlike the Arbitex thing again, where with Arbitex there's one way to do footnotes, there's one way to do this, there's one way to do that. In 3B2 there's like 3 or 4 different ways to achieve the same thing. And depending on what you're actually trying to do, some of those things may not work together in the best way. So really sort of 3B2's whole idea is that it gives you the ultimate power, but it's up to you to sort of take the responsibility for that power and apply to things in an intelligent fashion. I guess that's kind of the motto that they would give you.
Well, so no, I heard there was something that you personally learned from Laurie recently.
Yeah, he was very proud about that. When I was running my 3B200 VMware, it kind of squishes the screen a little bit on the page display, and I couldn't figure out why. I guess it's something to do with the way that the virtual graphics driver is reporting the stuff to 3B2, but apparently they had the same problem back in the old DOS days. I guess they didn't have proper graphic drivers and things back then, so... Laurie showed me this old adjustment file that let you actually fiddle your scaling on your page display, and boom, it fixed it. So he was very impressed to have shown me that, yeah. And I was quite pleased to have learned it, actually. It's been handy.
That's very cool. I'm so glad to hear that. He told me to ask. He didn't tell me what it was.
Yeah, he was very proud of that indeed.
Well, you know, those of us who are getting farther from our programming, we like to get it where we can.
That's it. Knock up the cheap runs on the board.
Oh, my goodness. Well, so let's see. What else can you tell me? Something, what was your most interesting customer for you personally?
Oh, the most interesting one that still sticks in my mind, because it was all sorts of bad as well as all sorts of good in the end, was Sigma Aldrich Corporation in St. Louis, Missouri. And they do a lot of catalogs for scientific sort of products, lab equipment, all these sorts of crazy things that scientists need to do their jobs. They've acquired a lot of companies, so they have a lot of different brands, which kind of makes it interesting from a catalog perspective, because they obviously have quite a range of catalogs. Their main general catalog, where they try and bring most things into, is actually quite large. I'd say a good 2,000-3,000 pages. So it's pretty heavy stuff, and they have some very specific needs around the catalog display as well, because it's all this scientific stuff. There's a lot of maths and formulas and not normal things, I guess you'd call them. And at the same time, because the catalogs are so damn big, they're reaching the limits of what they can actually bind together to make a book.
Wow.
So trying to avoid splitting into volumes means you've got to pack all that and crunch all that text and content in as much as possible. So that led to some really messed up layouts that they wanted to use for their listings, where you would scrunch up a little chemical thing in this corner, and you'd scrunch up all the descriptive text over here, and then if these things appeared but they weren't, you know, you didn't have enough space, you had to do this and that and do little sub-columns. You know, within the main columns, you had little sub-columns as well that it would flow content in. And then they also had a number of different sections. So you'd have, like, some of these sections which had anchored graphics, I guess, on the outside edge. So on the left-hand page, your graphics stack on the left. On the right-hand page, they stack on the right. You have... on those same pages, you could have spanning headings as well that spanned across both the columns, and everything had to align perfectly. So if the graphic was taller than the listing text, then the next listing obviously appeared below the graphic, whereas if it was vice versa, where the listing text was longer than the graphic, then the next listing appears below the listing text. So we had loads of fun trying to do that. I actually came into the project quite late. Advent had done, I think, two passes at fixing that. The first version didn't work too well. The second version worked kind of well, but it got so complex that it was very hard to maintain. Even doing a simple change and testing that through took, you know, the best part of a day. So that was clearly not a good situation to be in. We had the opportunity, when I was working with that Sydney reseller, we had the opportunity to go in there as kind of a third and final time. They were really clutching at straws by this point, and they said, how do we fix it? So I'd had the benefit of working a little bit on the maintenance of these nightmare templates, and I sort of could see a lot of the problem was just due to the complexity of mixing up all the formatting logic with all the composition logic, with all the business logic and everything else. So we came up with this model. We actually went in on site for a week and just sat down with their techies. And there was me and a guy from the Sydney office, and we just basically talked through on the whiteboard for a week solid how this should work. And this is across, they go from a database extract through to a printed book. And they also have a web output as well, so we had to consider all these different angles. And we ended up with the model, which I quite like, is where we took a database extract almost as an XML version of what was in the database. So it was not really good for publishing with. But what we did then is we took an XSLT, and we would run the XSLT to resolve all what we call the business logic, which was figuring out how do all these database bits fit together on the page. So obviously you have to process a lot of the text or reorder things or join things with other things and that sort of operations. And we had the XSLT layer to actually get rid of all that type of problem. And the first thing that brought was actually making the 3x2 template very simple, because instead of having to support about 300 different elements, we now supported about 25 elements, because once we got rid of all the business logic, all that was left was basically just figuring out what text needed to go on the page in what order. And we had some special elements for things like their special listing layouts and scrunching all that stuff up into a listing. But for the most part, we were allowed to just use paragraphs of text. So that meant that the job of the XSLT was quite complex, because it had to do a lot of different solving of things. But the job of 3x2 was quite easy. So their template, which was quite slow to run and was quite complex to debug, became very quick to run and very easy to debug. And what we find now is, in fact, they need very few changes to the template, because once it's mostly working for putting the stuff on the page, then you know, you don't really have to touch it after that. And all the work actually moves to the XSLT layer. Because they're always acquiring people and changing things around, they found they were doing a lot of changes to this business logic type of stuff. They might need a new XSLT, for example, because they've now got a new brand that does something slightly differently. But they're still able to crib off an old XSLT and just update that. And they actually had a consultant and even some in-house resources that were pretty good at XSLT. So that meant instead of every time they wanted to make a small change, you had to sort of go and spend a lot of money with a specialized consultancy. They were able to do a lot of that work themselves. And, you know, that served their business a lot better than... the other way. So they've been really happy with that, and that's a customer that always sticks in my mind, because that was a good feeling to be able to make a real difference. And even now they're still very happy with the system, and it's doing a lot of cool stuff, and they've extended it, and it's a cool solution. So that's definitely one that sticks in my head.
Wow, that's cool. We actually saw those documents when Laurie did his video podcast for us.
Oh, okay, and, great.
They were cool, I have to say. That's awesome.
Yeah,
nice to be able to move all that out.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, they've got some pretty cool stuff. And like I said, there's probably, I don't know how many they got now. When I was doing it, it was about 7 or 8 catalog different types they had for flavors and fragrances, and a Fluka branded one, the general catalog, and all the different sort of lab equipment sections and things like that. So it's quite a lot of different stuff. And it's good to have like one model that was able to deal with all that in an intelligent fashion.
Yeah, very cool to move the business logic out of it too. That's a typical mistake to make. Earlier.
Yeah.
Like, everybody makes it. It's the first time you go out, you've got it all, you're trying to get it out the door.
Yeah.
But
exactly. And I'm a big believer in prototyping, because I don't know if anyone could have come up with that solution without having done the sort of failed project type thing first and figuring out actually, you know, what was wrong.
I never get things right the first time, so, you know.
Yeah. Expect to
better.
Get it wrong the first time and then do it properly the next time, yeah.
Exactly right. That's what I say. Yeah. So I have one more question.
Okay.
It's hard enough for your standard tech pubs person who is maybe a production person, template person, and FrameMaker or whatever to make that jump to Fosse or Styler. How much harder is it to jump to 3x2? Do you need to be a programmer?
Yeah, it can be pretty tough. In my experience, and Laurie and Michael Duffy have slightly different ideas, but in my experience, the best result for that sort of person is coming from a sort of software engineering or programming background, because you're able to understand that assembler language type of mindset a little bit easier than your regular sort of FrameMaker user or whatever. Although, having said that, you know, there's been some very successful users that have come from just a desktop publishing background, but, you know, have taken up the 3x2 thing and understood how it worked and run with that. But I tend to find even those people still have kind of a technical mind to them. They're not strictly just from a InDesign type of mindset.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll leave that out there for the folks to be to consider when they go out to play.
Yeah. Well, lucky for most people, there's people like GPSL around, which do know an awful lot about 3x2, so you can still get the benefits without having to necessarily upskill your entire staff on the intricacies of 3x2. So.
Exactly. So tell us about GPSL here at the end.
Okay. So GPSL was formed at the end of 2007 or beginning of 2008. That was around the time that they incorporated the thing. It was... based on the acquisition of an older 3x2 consultancy called Pinpoint Composition, which was a couple of guys from the Advent 3x2 company that kind of got sick of the Arbitex and PDC corporate lifestyle and went out to do their own thing.
Right.
And they reached out to Laurie Stevens after he had been given leave from PDC and said, you know, hey, Laurie, we're having trouble sort of growing a business the way we want. You're pretty good at that stuff. Do you want to come and help out? I guess Laurie was kind of interested in that and not really doing much else right at that point in time. So, you know, he was able to come in and sort of take an intelligent look at things, say, you know, if we want to do this properly, we've got to do it properly and get funding together and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, Laurie's really got a lot of experience in that sort of field and a lot of contacts, was able to bring together the whole GPSL operation in that angle. And, you know, it was based on the idea of very similar, I guess, to the old Advent 3x2 idea of being, you know, a really good consultancy, doing good work, you know, in a very moral and with a lot of integrity, you know, that sort of idea. And I'm a big believer in that as well. So when PDC made me redundant, you know, I've been speaking to Laurie and stuff anyway, and he's kind of said, you know, do you want to come and do some work with us guys, you know, under that sort of basis? And I said, yeah, as long as I don't have to leave Australia. So we kind of had an agreement where I would sort of build the Asia-Pacific part of that up. And I guess it's kind of gone from there. So now we've got offices headquartered in the UK, obviously the Australian office here with me, and we have Canada, US, India, Philippines. Hmm. So kind of that's the G in global publishing solutions for you.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yes. And it's, you know, I can say I've seen all of those things just working with you and with Laurie the last couple of months and getting to know you all. Mm-hmm. It's been a great pleasure to find other people who are interested in stellar customer service and helping customers be successful themselves, not so much us.
Yeah. It's surprisingly rare these days, isn't it?
It is. It is. Yeah. So, all right.
Okay.
I'm going to wrap up and then, but, you know, you can go or you can stay. So anyway.
Okay.
So
well,
thank you
very
Gareth.
Much, yeah,
thank you. This... I'm so pleased to get as much information as I did, and I will pass this to everyone.
Okay, that's great. Okay, well, thanks everyone for listening, I guess, and hopefully catch up with everyone as well.
Well, we'll see you at PTC User next year, right?
Of course.
Of course. And you're going to do a little training session one day, possibly?
Yeah, why not?
I think that would be great, right? Teach everybody how to do it.
Yeah.
Now that they'll be playing with it and like, oh my God, what do I do now?
Yeah, we can run little courses on how to do some really cool, neat things.
That actually would be neat. I think that'd be very cool. All right, cool. All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Liz.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
The PubRide Podcast is a production of Single Sourcing Solutions in San Jose, California. Copyright 2009. Single Sourcing Solutions.